Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. According to a recent study, nearly 20% of military service members returned from Iraq and Afghanistan report symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression. Yet slightly more than half, only slightly more than half of them, have sought treatment. And also, according to this report, researchers found that only about half of the people who actually sought treatment received treatment that was adequate. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about this report in some detail. And our guest for the program is Terry Tenelian. She is the co-director of the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research and is a senior social research analyst at the RAND Corporation, and they're the outfit that did this report. Her background, her academic background, is in psychology, and she is interested in a number of things, including the psychological and cognitive injuries associated with combat, and also access to mental health services in the military health system. The report is quite detailed. You can certainly get a copy from RAND. The title is Invisible Wounds of War, Psychological and Cognitive Injuries, Their Consequences, and Services to Assist Recovery. So if you're interested in exploring this in great depth, you can certainly take a look at the report. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll try to cover the basics. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with questions. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, where the signal will travel, or you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the country, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join us. Ms. Tenelian, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Of course.
Maybe you could talk just a little bit about how it is that this study came to be, because it is my understanding that that outside of the military, this is the largest, most comprehensive study that to date has yet been undertaken to try to look at these issues.
That's correct. This really was an unprecedented study for its scope as well as its really kind of the approach that it took. We tried to address these particular problems, PTSD, depression, and traumatic brain injury among troops who had been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, from a societal perspective, trying to understand the size of the problem for the United States and really where we stood with respect to service systems to address them. So we had the opportunity to look across our U.S. healthcare system, look at both the services within the DOD as well as within the Department of Veterans Affairs, but also services that were available in the civilian sector.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, we can talk in detail about what you found, but I wonder whether you would say that overall your findings would suggest that it's not to say that we weren't aware that this was an issue, but did your findings suggest that perhaps it was a larger issue than we had been aware of?
Well, our study really pointed to the system-level issues that need to be addressed if we're going to be able to adequately address PTSD, depression, and traumatic brain injury among our U.S. service personnel. And we point to a number of issues that are challenges to the entire U.S. healthcare system that need to be addressed, so that the burden should not only rest with the DOD and the VA, but also in the other sectors of the U.S. healthcare system as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ed, when it comes to, maybe this, we're getting a little ahead of things here, but when it comes to treatment, for those people who seek treatment, are most of them looking for treatment within the military healthcare system or outside, or is it some of each?
They may be. It is complex. These are complex healthcare systems. Some service members may be eligible for healthcare services through the Department of Defense if they are still on active duty or affiliated with the Reserve and Guard and are TRICARE beneficiaries. Others are eligible for care through the Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system, particularly if they are within the 5 years of post-combat discharge. And others will seek services through private employer health insurance if they return to the workforce in the civilian sector, or may seek care in the public mental health sector in our communities.
Well, just give us some numbers. When we look at those individuals who have served in these two places, Iraq and Afghanistan, how many people come back and report having problems?
Sure. Well, as of last October 2007, we had about 1.64 million service members who had been deployed since October 2001 to either Iraq or Afghanistan. At the time that we conducted our study, which was late fall 2007, we identified that 18.5% of those who had been deployed, that's about 300,000 servicemen and women who had served in Iraq or Afghanistan, met criteria for PTSD or depression. So at that time, they were reporting symptoms of a level of significance that would be diagnosed with PTSD or depression.
And how do you know offhand how that might compare with people who have served in other American wars? Is that maybe about average?
Well, it's within the range of what we have observed in previous conflicts. It's difficult to make apples-to-apples comparisons, however, because we have a much better understanding now about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in our troops as a result of combat exposures than we did, for example, after Vietnam. We didn't have the diagnosis of PTSD until the late 70s, and so our understanding of this particular disorder and its treatment have really evolved over the past couple of decades. And so our screening tools are better, and we know what to do. We know how to provide effective treatments for these particular conditions.
Mm. Also, we have heard a lot about traumatic brain injury in this war, and that seems for a lot of people have said this, in fact, is maybe the most characteristic injury that people have suffered. And you also found apparently a similar number of people, or around that same number, said that maybe either they knew that they had one of these injuries, or perhaps they thought that they had one of these injuries.
Well, we were able to assess the types of experiences that individuals had while they were deployed. And based on the survey in which we asked about whether or not they experienced an injury or were exposed to a blast or had an accident that resulted in a loss or alteration of consciousness, an event that could lead to a traumatic brain injury, we found that 19.5% of service personnel reported that they had this type of experience. So they were exposed to a probable traumatic brain injury while they were deployed.
Hmm. I'm interested in it very clearly. I think that people would accept the notion that combat could lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. And some people say that they believe that they are experiencing symptoms of that. Also, there are people who talk about experiencing significant depression. I'm struck by one of the things that you note here in the summary is that apparently often depression isn't considered to be a combat-related injury.
Well, that's certainly true. Depression is associated with loss and grief. And so we know that a significant number of service personnel are experiencing loss and grief, either through the loss of comrades who have been injured or killed, but also from the separation of being away from their loved ones. And we found that depression is just as common as PTSD in this particular population. And so while it had not necessarily gained the headlines that PTSD has, we found it to be just as large a problem as PTSD for our returning veterans.
Well, if that's not considered to be combat-related, does that pose some sort of difficulties for people getting treatment?
Well, it shouldn't. To the extent that our returning veterans are suffering from these conditions and are eligible to receive health care, whether or not the depression is as a result of combat exposure should not preclude their ability to get mental health care for that depression.
Hmm. So you found that, as you said, you found that of the all those soldiers, all those service people who were deployed, who after coming back, said 18.5%, so that's looking at like about 300,000 individuals, said that they believe that they were experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder or depression. So of these 300,000 people, how many of them went out looking for help for treatment?
Well, again, we assessed their symptoms, so it was they did not tell us that they had PTSD or depression.
Oh,
we
okay.
assessed the symptoms
okay.
that they were currently experiencing, and so we are saying that their symptoms are consistent with a diagnosis of PTSD or depression. Of those that met these criteria, slightly more than half reported that they had sought care for a mental health problem in the prior year, so they may have gone to see a mental health care provider or physician or a chaplain to seek support for that mental health care. So too few are receiving care. And among those that did report receiving care, when we looked at the type of care that they had received based on what they told us, if they were receiving psychotherapy or they were taking medications and seeing a physician, according to the number of sessions or the length of those sessions, we found that only about half of those getting care were getting what would be defined as a minimally adequate set of services. So really a minimum dose of therapy for either PTSD or depression.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's deal with the first half of that. And let me ask you the question. When you asked people why it was for those people that did not seek help, if you asked them why, what would they tell you?
Well, three of the top five barriers that individuals reporting to getting care had to do with concerns about their career. So service men and women were concerned that by getting mental health care, it could have a negative repercussion on their career. They could be denied a security clearance, their coworkers may have less confidence in them, or it could just harm their career potential. And two of the top five were concerns about the effectiveness of the mental health care that they would receive.
So some of these people didn't seek care because they thought that it wouldn't help or that it wouldn't be good enough?
That's correct. Some believe it won't help, it won't be effective. But three of the top five barriers were concerned that by getting help, it could be held against them in their career.
Hmm. Is that something that it seems that even if that's just a perception, that would be difficult to change? And if that is in fact, if there is in fact within the military a kind of bias against people who have stood up and said that they are having emotional and psychological difficulties, it seems to me that would be extraordinarily difficult to change, particularly if that is part of the mindset of people within the military.
That's correct. And actually, the Department of Defense Mental Health Task Force that released a report last year called for a change in the culture of psychological health within the Department of Defense. So really making this a leadership challenge, an issue to change the culture of how psychological health is viewed within the military so that getting help can be seen as a sign of strength rather than a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm. And I would expect that also would particularly be an issue. That is, within the military, I would think that the ethic would be that it's always can do. You never want to say, I can't do this, I can't handle the pressure, I can't do the job, it's too tough, it's too dangerous. That it's what you always want to say is, yes, I can do that. And so I'm sure that it's very difficult for people to admit that something was really hard, that it was really stressful, that they got hurt either physically or psychologically, and that getting to the point where people can simply say, to talk about what's going on must be extraordinarily difficult.
Correct. And we've seen a number of programs that have been introduced to kind of train and educate military service personnel about the post-deployment stress that they may experience after deployments and after exposure to combat, and helping them to understand that it's okay to seek services and to seek help. So we need to ensure that confidential services are available very early so that individuals can seek that help before the problems become so severe or disabling that they can no longer do their jobs.
Hmm. Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest with this hour, Focus 580, is Terry Tenelian. She is the co-director of the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research at the RAND Corporation, and she is one of the editors of a recent report that RAND has done titled Invisible Wounds of War, taking a look at the kinds of psychological issues that returning veterans, people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, have, their willingness to seek help, and when they do, what the adequacy of that kind of help is. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone here to talk with, someone who is in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to welcome your guest and thank her for her participation today. And my comment is, I wanted to know if your guest was familiar with the work of Pamela Warren, Dr. Pamela Warren, who works here locally in Urbana and has done a lot of work in the civilian sector with developing systematic approaches to the sort of relationship between mental and physical injuries and how employers can basically use these types of systematic approaches to handle in the best interest of for the employer and for the employee to make sure that everybody gets proper care and that things are dealt with in the proper way and so on. Could those same sort of approaches not be applied to the military or tweaked in some way to be applied to the military as well? And wouldn't there be great value in that?
Well, that's a great point. I do not know the work of Dr. Warren personally. However, we do point to a number of models that can be found in the civilian sector. And the one that you mentioned may be, in fact, one of those where the military can learn from advances in the civilian sector about the integration of mental health care and primary care, for example, or other ways to kind of integrate employee health activities in a manner that can really focus on health and wellness rather than disease and treatment.
A lot of Dr. Warren's work has actually focused on the sort of symbiotic relationship that exists between physical injury and mental issues and how you can deal with those things effectively. In fact, they go very much hand in hand. And I think that just based on the discussion, and you were talking about the bias that may exist in the military against admitting that you have a problem. The better understanding of that and acceptance of that is pretty much key, I think, in that area for a good solution.
That's correct. Good point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Other
questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Would you say that if you look at the field of psychology as a whole, that our understanding of something like post-traumatic stress disorder and our ability to treat it is where it should be? That is do we have an issue here with the understanding and the techniques that are available? Or would you say, well, that really isn't the problem?
Well, that is partially a problem. We certainly know that effective treatments exist. So research has demonstrated that there are a number of therapies that are quite effective in reducing symptoms of PTSD and facilitating recovery. The challenge is that those types of therapies aren't being delivered as often as they could be. And that really stems from the number of providers. We have too few providers who are trained in delivering these types of interventions to individuals who may be suffering from PTSD. So we need to address the number of providers who are trained in these techniques, but then we also need to make sure that the systems that are in place to track and monitor the care that's being delivered to individuals who suffer from PTSD include the appropriate incentives and monitoring systems to make sure that that's the type of care that individuals can receive when they go to get healthcare. Unfortunately, today in U.S. healthcare, too few are getting quality care. And so we really need to close the gap in quality in healthcare more generally, but specifically around the treatment of PTSD and depression within the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it is true that we have talked about, that is, as a society, we've talked a lot about the problem of access to healthcare and the fact that there are a lot of people who don't have access. And I think it also a more serious access problem, and maybe one that has gotten some attention but not as much as it should, is access to mental health services. That may indeed be even more difficult. So we may be talking about something that is a national problem, that it doesn't just have to do with the military or doesn't have to do with just people who have served in the military and maybe needing mental health services. It's something that affects broadly. It affects all Americans.
That's correct. And so our recommendations really call for a change in the focus on access and quality of mental health care across the United States healthcare system that will benefit the care for our returning veterans as well as others. And so while the DOD and the VA are leading the way in addressing these issues, we really need to address them more broadly as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say that in your judgment, of those people who actually sought care, substantial numbers of them were getting about half of them were getting what you considered to be minimal care. Mm-hmm. That is, the quality just wasn't what it should have been. What really are the problems, and does that have, is that an access issue? Does it have to do with limitations on how much care people can get? Does it have to do with difficulty in finding a therapist or a counselor or a doctor who actually has the proper training and experience to deal with these issues?
Sure. Well, there are a number of barriers, again, to getting that high-quality care. Some of those are structural. So whether or not there are providers available, providers who are trained in delivering these particular types of techniques, whether or not an individual has access to that healthcare system within the DoD and the VA, these, are, again, have very kind of complex eligibility requirements. So an individual has to navigate whether or not they're eligible to get care within a certain sector, but then also finding a provider that has the appropriate training. But then we also need to look at our reimbursement system. Is our reimbursement system designed to incentivize the delivery of high-quality care so that a provider who is delivering therapy to a returning veteran has the incentive to make sure that they're delivering the best care that's available at that time versus just giving the usual care, which we know will not be very effective in facilitating recovery for PTSD and depression?
Mm. You talked about the fact that that people who are still in the military may be eligible to get health care through the military health care system, but that people who are separated from outside the military are not, then I'm assuming that then for their care they would have to go to the health care system that everybody else participates in. Do they get any help in trying to pay for care, or is that something that's completely on them?
When military personnel separate from military service, post-combat discharge, they have access to free care within the Department of Veterans Affairs healthcare system for up to 5 years. And so in that time, they can be evaluated, and if they are given a disability rating that would give them priority enrollment, they may then be eligible for care within the VA healthcare system as well. Many, however, will return to civilian employment and may also have private employer health insurance that they may be able to use to get health care, just as you or I would using our own health insurance and going downtown to get health care. Others may live far away from a VA facility or may not wish to use the VA health care system, may not be employed where they have health care insurance, and so may turn to our public sector to get health care as well, either with free clinics or in the Medicaid program.
Mm-hmm. So there, even if somebody is fortunate enough to have a job that provides health insurance, we may be going back to the problem we were talking about before, where there sometimes are limits placed on what kind of care that you can get or how many times that you can see a doctor, which is often not adequate to dealing with the problem.
That's correct.
What are the costs that we're associating with this? And maybe some people would say that that's an unfortunate question when we're talking about human beings, but I think we do indeed have to consider the costs to the individuals and also costs to society of either providing care or, worse, what are the costs of not providing care?
Well, that's a really good question. We did examine the consequences that may be associated with having PTSD and depression and demonstrate that through prior experience with research, we know that there's a negative set of consequences associated with having PTSD or depression that can accrue to an individual and to society. We see consequences for other health outcomes as well as crime, premature mortality and suicide as well as homelessness. But we actually were able to build an economic model to look at the cost in dollar terms that may be associated with having PTSD and depression. And so within 2 years, we estimate that the cost of providing medical care, costs associated with lost productivity, that is lost productivity in this labor market, as well as costs associated with suicide for PTSD and depression over just 2 years is about $6.2 billion. And so that's based on an estimate of the status quo, in which only about a third of those with PTSD or depression will get evidence-based care. Now, we were also able to demonstrate that by increasing the number of individuals who get access to high-quality care and ensuring that 100% of our veterans get evidence-based care following deployment for PTSD and depression, we can save $2 billion over just that 2 years. So by investing more in providing treatment, we see savings through increases in productivity and lowered rates of suicide.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint here, and I'd like to introduce once again our guest, Terry Tenelian. She works for the RAND Corporation. She's the co-director of the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research. She is a psychologist by her training and works in a number of fields, including military health care and policy, also the psychological and behavioral health issues related to combat. And she is one of the editors of a report that the center, the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research, has put out recently, Invisible Wounds of War, which takes a look at this very issue, some of the psychological issues that are associated with combat, their consequences, and what help there is out there to help veterans who do come back experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder or other sorts of injuries, psychological, cognitive injuries related to their combat experience. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. When people come back from serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, does the military, as a sort of a routine matter, do screening to determine whether or not they're having problems, or is it up to the individuals themselves to say, yes, I think I'm having a problem, and then from there go out and try to get some help?
Well, there are screening programs. Upon redeployment, when service members are returning, they are put through a process of post-deployment health assessment screenings where they complete a form to indicate what types of symptoms they may be experiencing. That's upon their return. And then about 3 to 6 months later, there's the post-deployment health reassessment, which provides another opportunity to check in with that individual service member to see how they're doing and, if needed, make an appropriate referral. There have been some concerns about these screenings. There's a lot of variation in how they're implemented between the services and at the unit level. Some are filled out in groups, some are filled out online, et cetera. And there's also been some concern that an individual service member may not wish to report symptoms that they may be experiencing at that time because it could hold up their return home. And so that if they indicate they're having problems, it may take them a few extra days before they get back to their family.
Mm-hmm. So that, and I guess I would expect that if again, people are hesitant to say that they have a problem, that here that's going to keep people from saying that they're having difficulties, and rather just and I suppose there might also be concerns about confidentiality and who else is going to know. So that might also be something that would hold people back from saying that they had symptoms when they did.
Exactly. And that is one of the concerns and really kind of the impetus behind our recommendation to ensure that confidential treatments are available to service members so that they can seek counseling or support off base, off the record, during off-duty hours, so that they can really get the help they need without fearing those repercussions.
Mm-hmm. Is that really? I would think that would be difficult in a military atmosphere like that, where you've got to account for what you're doing and where you're going, and there are people who are looking over your shoulder at what you're doing, and that we just have people all living very closely together. That it would be, I would think, it would be difficult to maintain that level of confidentiality.
Yes, likely it would be very difficult to maintain that level of confidentiality. However, we need to make sure that we can put into place policies that will facilitate service members getting the help they need as early as possible so that we can stem those consequences and ensure that they can be facilitated toward recovery before the problems accrue to a level that they can't do their job, they can't be deployed. And so really it's about increasing our force readiness rather than waiting for it to completely dissipate.
Mm-hmm. I could also mention, too, that an individual, if there's some question about their redeployment, that this should be a significant issue. That is, if you have somebody already who's having difficulties, at that point, you would want to get them into treatment and not put them right back in the situation that produced the problem, and which you'd think would only stand a good chance of making things worse. How, maybe you could talk a little bit more about how people, what sort of assessment is made of people about whether or not they're ready to go back, and whether that, again, where are the weaknesses in that?
Well, each service implements its pre-deployment health assessments a little bit differently, and they use periodic health assessments and other types of pre-deployment health screenings to determine whether or not an individual is deployable. Our study didn't necessarily look at the gaps in those systems. However, if an individual is experiencing an acute psychiatric disorder or problem that requires treatment, that would render them non-deployable.
Let's talk with someone here who's listening in Urbana, where we are. This is line one.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if you've ever done a study on the other 4 out of 5 that don't exhibit these symptoms as to why that might be, and then of the ones that do come above the radar, to what extent their surfacing had anything to do with a family member, a wife, parents, siblings, whatever, being part of them coming forward?
Those are great questions. We actually did not look at the role of family support in getting help, although it would be a key factor in facilitating getting care. We know that natural support systems can be very critical in ensuring that an individual gets the help that they need. In terms of looking at the risk factors associated with PTSD and depression, we were able to observe a number of individuals who were at higher risk, including those who were enlisted versus officers, those in the Army and Marines versus those in the Navy and the Air Force. We found that the number of combat exposures that an individual experienced was really the single best predictor of them currently experiencing PTSD or depression. What then gets an individual into care? That's a very important question that we hope to be able to examine more closely in follow-on studies, because it would be critical to understand how we can really address some of these barriers to care so that we can close the gap in access and close the gap in quality.
We certainly don't want to make the problem even bigger than it is, because already we're talking about 300,000 people who were determined to have post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, or perhaps also in addition have something, have traumatic head injury issues. So that's a lot of people right there. But you do also wonder about the other 4 of 5, whether there still might be a possibility for those people that at some time later they might also have problems, and that it was just, you know, it depends on at what point you make your assessment. Do you make it a month after they've come back, or 6 months, or 1 year, or 2 years, and whether your numbers might actually go up over time?
Well, and that certainly is a possibility. Our study was a point-in-time assessment, and so it is possible that more individuals experienced these types of symptoms before and had since resolved, and it may be that additional individuals will experience symptoms to a level of severity that would rise to the level of having a diagnosis of PTSD or depression later. And so there are a number of individuals who may experience PTSD and depression at some point in the future, either through delayed onset or other triggers that could bring back the memories and the reminders of this traumatic experience and cause a problem for them at some point in the future. And one of our recommendations is that we really need to be following this cohort of veterans longitudinally so that we can understand the course of PTSD and depression in this population over time, to see if we see spikes in the incidence and prevalence of PTSD or depression, as well as to examine the impact of treatment. We have historic opportunity to ensure that we can deliver effective care to this generation of veterans now more than ever. Can we demonstrate that by delivering high-quality care now, will stem some of those consequences later, so that this generation will have a different trajectory than prior ones?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. So we have somebody on a cell phone on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, good morning. Thanks
yes.
for letting me talk.
Sure.
I was curious how does it break down as far as each service goes? How many people experience these problems from each of the services? And also, what has RAND done as far as more widespread studies? Well, this is American conflicts, but overall in the world, how does PTSD come out in other societies? I'll just take off and listen. Thank you.
right?
Sure. Well, in our report, we do provide a breakdown of the kind of the characteristics of our sample. And so our particular survey was conducted on a population that is representative of the full deployed population. And we don't provide estimates that are broken down by service. However, we do find that our rates are generally comparable to the rates that have been published by the Department of Defense, where you see higher rates among Army and Marines and lower rates among Navy and Air Force, for example. In terms of comparing the prevalence of PTSD and depression in this cohort of individuals, the returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and comparing them to other populations, we know that the rate of PTSD and depression in the United States civilian population is about 3.5% for PTSD and 7% for depression in any one year. And so we find that the rates of PTSD and depression are much higher in the military population. Our rates of PTSD and depression were each 14%. So that's 14% compared to 3.5% and to 7%. So you get three times and two times the rate as you do in the civilian setting.
And I don't know if the caller was also thinking about perhaps a question like, if you look at the experiences of soldiers from other countries, you know, British soldiers, French soldiers, German soldiers, you know, people who have served in combat, do you see the same sorts of things? I would imagine that the experience of other soldiers, other places, other combat situations would be roughly similar.
Well, but that's an important point, that you have to understand the exposures and the characteristics of those populations. So making strict comparisons can be difficult, but our rates are generally comparable to populations that have been exposed to combat at the rates that the United States troops have been. Hmm.
And I guess you also have to acknowledge that it's called post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's not called post-traumatic combat stress disorder. That is, other kinds of people who have been through other kinds of very difficult experiences can in fact have PTSD. Maybe the place that we think about it most is people who have been in military combat, but it can be the result of other kinds of extremely traumatic experiences.
That's correct. Motor vehicle accidents, assault, rape, other causes and other traumatic exposures can be the impetus for someone suffering from PTSD. In our group of, in our survey, we were able to compare servicemen and women who reported having combat exposures with those who reported having no combat exposures, and we found that combat exposure was a significant predictor of having PTSD. In the group that had no combat exposures, we found rates of PTSD and depression at 1% and 3%, respectively, so quite low, and we see that combat exposure is very, very important in the military population in terms of predicting PTSD and depression.
Yeah. So again, so we're talking about here a significant number of people, 300,000 people coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan with either PTSD or depression or both. I wonder, too, because we've certainly heard stories about people coming back and having a difficult time getting back into civilian life and getting back into family life and work life and trying to resume what they were doing before they went off to serve. And I wonder how many people might be having difficulties that maybe don't rise to the level of clinical depression, for example, or PTSD, but they're still having difficulties reintegrating, and they're the kind of things that maybe could be helped by having some level of counseling. And again, that people are not going for help for some of the same reasons. Either they don't want to admit that they need help, or that they're having a difficult time actually with the access issue, and so that the problem in a sense might even be larger than we're talking about here.
Absolutely. We need to be thinking about programs and policies that can facilitate successful reintegration and transition. And we've seen a lot of focus and attention on that within the Department of Defense as well as the VA in thinking about the reintegration and transition process. We know from prior experience that facilitating a good transition and providing social support can help mitigate whether or not an individual actually will develop a post-combat disorder. So facilitating successful reintegration is quite key. And there may be many, many individuals who are having a difficult time in that transition. And so we focus specifically on those that rose to the level of, you know, a PTSD or depression diagnosis. But there are others who still may be having difficulties during that transition and who may benefit from support and counseling.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Terry Tenelian. She is a psychologist. She's the co-director of the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research at the RAND Corporation, and among other things is interested in military health care and also some of the psychological issues related to being involved in combat. She is one of the editors of a report that the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research has put out, Invisible Wounds of War. That takes a look at psychological problems suffered by veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and their some of the difficulties and barriers that they face to getting counseling and help when they come back. If you're interested in finding out more about RAND, you can look at their website, which is RAND.org, and you can also, I'm sure, get a copy of the report from them if you would like to read it. There is a great deal of detail in here, much more than we can go into in the time that we have, so if you really want to give it a more close reading, you can do that. And questions are welcome here, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think one of the things that you talked about was that in order to meet the need, what we're going to have to do is have more counselors, people who are actually trained in dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that what exactly is involved in that? Is that really complicated to get someone who is already experienced as a counselor or a therapist up to the point where he or she could take on that kind of client?
Well, it's possible. We really need a sharp increase in the number of providers who are trained in delivering evidence-based therapy for PTSD and depression, but we need them across a continuum of providers. And so while we need individuals who are trained in the specialty mental health field where they would be going and getting their doctorate degree or a master's in social work or whether they be a psychiatrist or a primary care physician, we also need to ensure that we have individuals in the supportive therapy, chaplains, as well as other mental health counselors who are trained in detection as well as in evidence-based care for PTSD and depression to ensure that we can really have this rapid expansion in the number of providers who are trained to treat these conditions. We have a shortage of these types of professionals and the level of training in the U.S. healthcare system more broadly, so this is a critical pipeline issue. So we need to retrain existing providers in evidence-based practices and evidence-based care, but we also need to think about the pipeline of providers who are coming into these professions to ensure they get the appropriate training in diagnosing and treating PTSD and depression as well.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I'm calling to add just a comment, and if it's something you've already mentioned, I apologize because I'm joining you late. Mm-hmm. I wondered how beneficial it would be if the military leadership at the highest levels would come out on record as acknowledging the importance of soldiers getting treatment for PTSD, making this a very acceptable choice for them. There's so much of a stigma involved in the society at large, but especially in the military, that having leadership come out on record and make it a policy that this is something that is acceptable. When a soldier chooses treatment, it's a positive thing so that they can be at their best in their service. Having leadership come out on record as supporting this might help to gradually institute this throughout all the levels of the military. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that is actually very crucial and is something that the military has recognized. And that is one of the things that we're starting to see is a number of military leaders coming forward and acknowledging that they've sought help themselves or encouraging their unit members to do the same and noting the importance of them getting help and keeping themselves healthy. And the new Defense Center of Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury is really kind of encouraging this leadership stepping forward and acknowledging that getting help is important. We've also seen the department change the security clearance application. So there's been a revision in the language that asks the question about the use of mental health services. So we see a number of positive steps toward removing this barrier in the organizational and culture of the military with respect to mental health care.
Let's talk next with someone in Indiana, in Terre Haute, on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What was PTSD called before PTSD? And also, what was there to offer by the educational institutions before psychology was called psychology? Thank you.
Well, I don't know how easy to answer the second question. The first question, clearly, there was the recognition that there was severe stress and psychological consequences of being in combat. And we've known that probably for as long as human beings have been in combat. And for at least going back to World War I, I think that it has been called different things. Before the most recent PTSD, but before that, we called it all sorts of different things.
That's correct. And in fact, really, these types of injuries are as old as warfare itself. It may have been called shell shock, battle fatigue, the blues. And so we've seen an evolution in our understanding of this particular condition. And so now we have the recognition and the diagnostic criteria for what's now called post-traumatic stress disorder. We also recognize acute stress reactions, combat operational stress. And so we have a number of terms that allow us to understand the phenomenology that individuals will experience after being exposed to combat and other forms of trauma. The other question is a little bit harder to answer in terms of the history of the mental health profession, but we certainly have seen an evolution in our understanding of PTSD.
We maybe on some other day we can talk about the history of psychology. I guess modern psychology as we know it now is probably not very old. It's a 19th century, I guess you'd have to say it's a 19th century sort of development.
Yes.
Yeah. Other calls are welcome here. We do have a minute or two left. Somebody wants to call real quick. We can get them in. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I wonder, you know, we've talked about the fact that we have a significant number of individuals affected, 300,000 people. And at the same time, you might want to make the point, and certainly you do make the point, that most of the people who have served there, and if we're talking about over 1.6 million people have been deployed, most of them are doing okay. That's not saying maybe they don't have any problems at all. Most of them are doing okay. And I guess I wonder within the military whether there is a genuine fear about how if they admit that there is a significant problem, how that reflects on the military and whether they would just assume, whether they think they're dealing with this and they're dealing with it more quietly and that somehow they had thought that was adequate and maybe necessary for the image of the military not to play up the fact that we do have 300,000 people with PTSD or depression and who knows how much larger a problem we have at a slightly lower kind of level.
Well, the military has certainly worked very aggressively to put in place a number of programs and services to ensure that servicemen and women who are suffering from post-combat stress can find help in dealing with those experiences. But it was important to also kind of understand the size of the problem right now in the United States, because not only the DOD and the VA are going to be addressing this problem, but the U.S. healthcare system more broadly. Our returning veterans will seek care in any number of sectors, and so it's important for the United States to kind of understand what is the size and scope of the problem so that we can also address the gaps in the care system to ensure that our veterans who have served and sacrificed so much can get the best care available to them.
Try to get one more caller. Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hi, I'm calling with a quick question. My younger brother has just returned from 2 tours of combat duty in Iraq, and I'm kind of wondering if you could give me some tips on how to notice if he's suffering from PTSD or how to get him to open up best or just in general how to be there for him. I'll listen off here. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, it is certainly important for you to be there for him and to understand and let him talk with you about his experiences. But I'd also direct you to some resources that are available on our website. We were able to put together some brochures that describe post-deployment stress for the service member, as well as a booklet for family members of individuals who had served in either Iraq or Afghanistan. You can find those materials, as well as a whole host of other resources about PTSD, depression, as well as traumatic brain injury, at veterans.ran.org. There you'll be able to download some of these booklets, as well as our report, and find other web links to resources about post-deployment stress, so you can understand the signs and symptoms of these conditions, as well as find resources of where someone can go to get help.
Okay, so again, that's veterans.rand, so that's R-A-N-D, .org.
Correct.
Okay. And I think probably, again, if people are just interested in finding out more about RAND, they can go to the RAND website, which is rand.org. Lots of information on all kinds of different subjects. But this one in particular, if that's what you're looking for, go to that place there. Well, we're just about at the point where we have to finish up. I think we've given a good overview. And again, if people want to read in greater depth, they can actually get a copy of the monograph that you've done, Invisible Wounds of War. And what's sort of the last idea that you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, the last idea is really that we have a number of challenges that we need to address within our healthcare system to ensure that our veterans can get the care that they need. This is certainly a very unique workforce, one that the United States needs to have in place and at full readiness standards for the future. And so we need to ensure that we can really address the gaps in access and quality to make sure that they get the care that they need when they do suffer from PTSD or depression.
All right. Our guest this morning, Terry Tenelian. She's the co-director of the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research at the RAND Corporation, and is the co-editor of Invisible Wounds of War, Psychological and Cognitive Issues, Their Consequences, and Services to Assist Recovery. This report recently put out by the RAND Center for Military Health Policy Research. And again, you can go to their website, rand.org, and find out more. And thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to the engineer, Jessica Goldings, who is there on the other end of our connection there at RAND.